Next case on our calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Jonas. Good morning, counsel. While you're getting settled, I'll remind you each that you have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments, because they are being recorded, and we'll just give your predecessor some time to remove his items, and then when you are ready, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Prometer, and I am here on behalf of Emil Jonas. Emil Jonas was deprived of her right to a fair trial in three significant ways. First, the prosecution's discovery violations deprived the defendant of her constitutional right to a fair trial. Second, the cumulative effect of prosecutorial misconduct during closing arguments deprived the defendant of a fair trial. And third, the trial court's decision to delay their ruling on the motion for judgment of acquittal until after the defense had begun their case, and the trial court's failure to grant the motion for judgment of acquittal, again deprived the defendant of her right to a fair trial. In regard to the discovery violations, during the defendant's trial, two significant pieces of discovery came to light. Most importantly, a recording of a statement taken by a child protection caseworker while speaking to the defendant, her husband, and their two daughters was missing. The recording was missing, and the prepared transcript was missing.
Okay, I'm struggling on this discovery violation because I don't know that we have a record that says that the district court did anything with respect to the claimed discovery violations. As I understand the record, these issues came up that the prosecutor gave defense counsel notice that these items were going to be used in cross-examination, and that the defense counsel wasn't aware right then whether the recordings had been provided or not. The prosecutor's records seemed to suggest they had been, but the district court was never asked to rule on these discovery violations because the parties found a way to deal with it. And so what is there for us to review?
Well, the court has the authority to reverse and remand based on supervisory power over the trial court, the interests of justice, and the interests of underscoring the discovery rules. While defense counsel did not specifically ask for a ruling whether or not there was a discovery violation, and they did come to a solution, the bottom line is that the defense was put in a position of arguing alternative strategies and bringing witnesses back.
I just am finding it hard to understand what plain error analysis we should undertake here, that we're a district court. You're saying the district court, even though the parties agreed to this kind of four-part solution to deal with this issue, the district court should have intervened and said, that's not good enough? Where the parties had agreed? I just, help me here, because I don't see any authority for that.
I think that this court has authority to make sure that defendants are given fair trial rights. And the discovery violations in accumulation with the prosecutorial misconduct and the erroneous ruling, the erroneous reservation of the ruling, make this seem as though this was an unfair trial for the defendant. And this is just one piece. This is a piece of the analysis that this court can undertake to reverse and remand to allow the defendant to have a fair trial.
Do you agree that the record reflects that the substance of this recorded interview had been provided in the child protection file? That the summary I think a child protection worker had summarized in written form the gist of the interviews, and that had been provided?
Yes.
So then how would there be any, even assuming that there were discovery violations, how is there prejudice to your client?
Because during the recess when defense counsel took a break to review this two-hour recording. Within the first 30 minutes, they realized, and this is reflected in the record, they realized that these summaries that the child protection caseworker had provided did not fully encompass what had actually happened in this two-hour recording. And they noted that if they had known about this recording, they would have prepared their trial strategy completely differently, and that was just within the first 30 minutes. Although they did cobble together a solution to this problem, and they didn't specifically ask for a mistrial, it's clear that they were put in the position of arguing alternative strategies, bringing witnesses back, which resulted in counsel looking like they didn't know what they were doing, and it presented an inconsistent defense for the defendant. All of this stems from the late disclosure that put the defendant at a distinct disadvantage, which could have very well led to her conviction. Everyone knew that this was a problem. The prosecutor said, hopefully the jury won't notice or even care, and the court agreed. And while we can't say if the jury did notice, it's quite possible that a different strategy in trial preparation could have affected this verdict. The prosecution also failed to disclose photos of the complaining witness during the medical examination. This was the initial medical examination. This failure inhibited defense counsel from being able to properly prepare a defense or having meaningful conversations with their medical expert regarding the abuse of the complaining witness. Cumulatively, these discovery violations deprived the defendant of her due process right to a fair trial. She was not able to meaningfully craft a defense or question witnesses because the recording of her statement was not disclosed to defense counsel. And again, this court
does... But we don't know that. Again, there was no finding, right?
Correct.
I'm not wrong about that. There's no finding.
No, you are not.
And in fact,
wrong.
You know, defense counsel seemed to think, I don't recall it, but I thought Mensis records or the e-filing records indicated it had been provided. I mean, there was no definitive evidence that there had been a violation with respect to the recording.
Correct. It was noted in the record that it was the prosecutor's notes that indicated that this transcript had been disclosed. And I would note that this was a joint trial, so there were two defense attorneys, and neither one of them had received this information. In regard to the prosecutorial misconduct, there are four instances of misconduct in the closing argument. The first was a reference to a power imbalance between adults and children. The second was a discussion of the vulnerability of children. The third was a statement regarding how the complaining witness's testimony alone is sufficient to convict. And the fourth was a reference to the legislature.
And are any of this, I mean, this, you would agree that the statement of a child victim is enough in a case as under the law to convict. I mean, that's not an erroneous statement, is it?
No, it's not.
And the first two comments that you referenced really were comments in terms of credibility, judging the credibility of the child witnesses as opposed to the adult witnesses, right?
The first two statements is that I reference are in regard to the issue that I have with them is that they are broad statements. They are not discussing the specific complaining witness and his, you know, credibility or vulnerability. They're talking about broad societal woes and asking for the jury to correct the issues to protect future victims of child abuse. And this is inflaming the passions of the jury. If the prosecutor had narrowed these statements to the specific complaining witness, they would have been appropriate. However, these were broad statements about all children and all adults and power dynamics. In regard to discussing about...
And how would that make a difference as a practical matter? If, as you suggest, the prosecutor had talked about M.O. and the power imbalance between M.O. and his parents, how would that be less likely to inflame a jury than a broader statement about the imbalance, if you will, between an adult witness and a child witness?
Because it's within the scope of the case. It's within the scope of the case, and you're asking the jury to pay attention to the specific facts and evidence before them in this action, not to think about the broader societal ramifications of their ruling within society. And in regard to whether or not the complaining witness's testimony alone is sufficient to convict, of course that is accurate, but the statement that the prosecution made was phrased in a way that led the jury to believe that they did not have to look at all of the other evidence, and the only thing they had to consider was the witness's testimony. The state's position is that even if this was an error, it is inappropriate to reverse because the prosecutor's statements did not substantially affect the jury's verdicts is false. The jury acquitting of the top count is of no matter. The jury convicted the defendant of multiple other charges. Each of these statements individually is misconduct, but the cumulative effect, as well as in conjunction to the discovery violations, warrant a new trial. In regard to the motion for judgment of acquittal, it was plain error that the trial court reserved its ruling.
I think the state agrees.
They do agree. Yes, that is correct.
So the question there is, what difference does it make?
The difference is that even, you know, obviously there was an error in reserving the ruling, but there was also an error in the ruling itself. We argue that the court should have granted the motion for acquittal, which would have affected how the defense would have presented evidence, if at all.
But that's not an issue on appeal. I thought the appeal issue was the failure to timely rule on that motion.
I believe that I brought both issues within my brief.
Well, you can go ahead with your statement. We'll
thank you.
Certain check on
thank
that.
You. In this case, the judge delayed ruling, but it seems as though the court was more concerned with the jury waiting than giving this motion due consideration, which is reflected in the record. The judge should have timely dismissed count one, the felony count, which the jury eventually acquitted on. If it was granted in a timely fashion, they could have narrowly focused the testimony of the medical examiner to be more persuasive. If the felony count was properly excluded before going forward, defense might have decided not to put Ms. Yonas at risk by having her testify. If the court had granted the motion for judgment of acquittal or it was timely ruled upon, defense counsel could have made different tactical decisions.
You wouldn't have had as many charges to defend against, so that would make sense.
Correct. And again, they would have made different tactical decisions. They would have made different decisions regarding their medical expert, and they might not have had Ms. Yonas testify.
So on the merits of the motion for acquittal, what's your strongest argument that the district court erred?
I don't know.
So your primary argument is the delay?
The primary argument is the delay. However, we hold that there's not enough evidence to support any of the charges that were brought against Ms. Yonas and that the motion for judgment of acquittal should have been granted. I know that the defense counsel went into the fact that there wasn't bodily harm. There was discussion about whether or not the starvation actually happened, what the hyperpigmentation was, and what evidence was presented to the jury. And we argue that there wasn't enough to bring these charges forward.
Counsel, would that go back to what Judge Bjorken asked you earlier, though? Doesn't that ultimately go to the credibility of M.O.? Wouldn't the testimony of M.O.'s be sufficient itself to support the convictions?
Yes. However, again, the jury needs to look at all of the evidence that was presented by the state in establishing the credibility of the complaining witness. So, in conclusion, all of these issues deprive the defendant of her constitutional right to present a meaningful defense in the decision about how to cross-examine witnesses and how to craft her narrative of innocence. The conviction should be vacated, and this matter should be reversed and remanded to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jean Burdorf. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. None of the arguments in appellant's brief support reversal of the convictions by the jury in this particular case. With regard to the discovery violation, appellant is asking for a remedy, a new trial that they specifically rejected below. That's at page 1283 and 1284 of the transcript. The trial defense counsel specifically said, we don't want to have a new trial in this case. We don't want a mistrial. We want to take this case to verdict. So having said that to the district court, obviously the significant efforts were made to ameliorate the alleged discovery violation. Judge Bjorken, you're right. The record is unclear about whether a discovery violation occurred at all. What you will see from pages 1270 to 1274, that's where the meat of this conversation happens at the district court level. It's unclear. There were three audio files that were disclosed by the prosecution in May before this trial. The prosecutor believed that the statements to the child protection worker were on those. The defense, and I think the defense was being truthful and straightforward and ethical. There's no misconduct alleged here. I think didn't have them, hadn't seen them. And that does sometimes happen in district court practice, particularly in cases like this where there's such a significant amount of discovery. Things get missed. But it is important that the district court didn't specifically make a finding that there actually had been a discovery violation. And largely, I think that is because no one asked the district court to do that. And also because the parties and the defense trial counsel, again, said this repeatedly throughout, the prosecutor really bent over backwards to try to ameliorate any potential prejudice to the defendant.
Would you be looking at this issue then for plain error, or how would we look at the discovery violation?
I actually am not sure, because the defense did object and claim there was a discovery violation. There just was no finding made by the district court, and I don't think the record actually supports a finding that a discovery violation was made. The way the district court analyzed it, and this court could certainly do the same, is to essentially assume even if there was a discovery violation, given the significant efforts to ameliorate any potential prejudice to the defendants in this case, reversal just wouldn't be warranted. The Lindsay factors that we use in criminal law to determine whether a discovery violation, you know, what kind of remedy is warranted, you can apply those factors to the evidence in this particular case. And the result that you would reach is that there was no basis to reverse the conviction. Appellant's counsel has said that they were forced to pursue an inconsistent trial strategy and that they would have changed what they did in the case as a matter of strategy had that report or the audio tape come to light earlier. And I think that the record doesn't support that assertion. First of all, as Judge Brookman, as you noted, there were detailed child protection summaries of these statements. The witnesses that...
But it's not the same as a two-hour recording. It is. It has a lot more than... And what the child protection worker may have thought was significant in that interview might not be what the defendant thought was important.
And I agree. I agree with you. I'm not suggesting that those were mirror images of one another. It's just a fact that this court can consider that there certainly... It wasn't as though the defense was surprised and didn't have any idea what the daughters, who are the two primary witnesses who had already testified, said during those interviews. What happened at trial is both daughters got up and said the home was fine, M.O. and C.K. were never punished, they weren't starved, they weren't forced to stand, everything was perfectly normal. I think it's apparent from the child protection summaries that that is not what they told the child protection worker. So certainly the defense, before any witness was called, was on notice that the intended testimony of those daughters was going to be at least somewhat inconsistent with what they had already told the child protection worker in August of 2017. So it's a very small point, but it really is that they were on notice that there was going to be some inconsistency created. But that said, a two-hour audio isn't the same as a summary. And what the district court did in this particular instance is gave a continuance, which is what Lindsay recommends to ameliorate prejudice, gave defense counsel an opportunity to look at those. And then what the remedy was, Ms. Yonas was permitted to, was recalled and was permitted to clarify prior testimony. I will confess, having looked at the testimony she originally gave and her clarified testimony, I didn't note anything particularly significant about the differences. But also, so we had a continuance, we had a recalling, and then the prosecution agreed to stipulate to part of the daughter's statements that Ms. Yonas had identified and felt would help her case. So given all of those remedial measures and the nature of the case, the defense strategy was that M.O. was lying and had fabricated all of these allegations. It is not clear to me how the slight inconsistencies between anything Ms. Yonas and her daughters might have said to the child protection worker in August would have changed that strategy. That was the strategy they opened on, and that's the strategy they pursued all throughout trial. So to me, it is not clear how strategy really truly would have been affected.
by an earlier disclosure of those audio tapes, assuming they weren't disclosed. So I'll move on to prosecutorial error. There are four allegations of error. I think I've addressed them adequately in my brief. I would like to say this, though, about plain error. These were unobjected to comments. Plain error, error is, first of all, it has to be an error. It has to be clear. And I would like to stop and talk for a moment about what clear error is. It's something that violates a statute, a rule, or a case. Appellant's counsel didn't cite a single case that has similar facts to this particular case. That is what you typically see in an argument of plain error. Someone will point to an analogous or similar case and say, the Court of Appeals or Minnesota Supreme Court told prosecutors not to do this, and here's the case that says that. The prosecutor here did that. That doesn't exist in this particular case.
How do you respond, though, to counsel's argument before us today that the basic problem with these four aspects of the closing argument was that they weren't tied to these facts in this case, but that they seem to invite the jury to think more broadly about, you know, witnesses and children versus adults and things like that? How do you respond to that argument?
I have a couple responses to that. First of all, the two arguments that I think we're really talking about with this broad scope and impropriety claim is that the argument that there's a power imbalance between adults and children, and that kids can be vulnerable and can be afraid and often can delay reporting, particularly against caregivers.
And which is why the legislature has broadly defined abuse.
Abuse, exactly.
Best in all these ways.
Both of those arguments were actually made. So I think what appellant's counsel has done is said, taken plucked out sentences of an argument and said, these look wrong, or these were error. But if you read them in the larger context of the argument, it is clear that the prosecutor actually is talking about M.O. and his brother, C.K., who both testified consistently about this pattern of longstanding abuse. And in both instances, if you look at the text before and after, so those highlighted phrases, what you see is the prosecutor explaining the defense argument, and it was a primary argument, was if Emma was telling the truth about these allegations of abuse, he would have reported it to a teacher or a religious figure or his therapist or someone else in his life earlier. And that was a central theme. And that's a perfectly valid defense argument, but when you make that argument, I think the prosecutor does have a right to counter it by arguments that look like this, which is kids don't report sometimes promptly, and sometimes they do delay because they are afraid. I think there's really two components to each of these arguments that are being challenged. One is, for instance, there's a power imbalance between kids and adults. I think that's just a common sense, common experience argument that is perfectly valid for a prosecutor to make. I don't think you actually need testimony. That just strikes me as something that falls within a common experience, and that is permissible for prosecutors to argue to jurors, we know this. There's a power imbalance. Parents control a lot of their kids' lives. That gives them kind of an upper hand. That's just a very common sense experience for a juror to have. The second, about delayed reporting, there actually was testimony in the record from Jennifer Prax, who's a family court custody evaluator, and from the state's expert on child abuse, Dr. Nancy Harper. Both of those witnesses talked about how fearful kids are when they're in these situations where they've been abused by caregivers, and how often that fear does result in a reluctance to report, incremental reporting, and sometimes just very, very delayed reporting. So there was evidence in the record specifically on these points, and then making that essentially a fair space for the prosecutor to make arguments. And again, I gave you a very, very long answer to your question, but my short answer is that those statements are being read out of context. The prosecutor really was talking about the witnesses and the evidence in this particular case. The last claim of prosecutorial error is that the testimony of M.O. alone wasn't enough to support the conviction. I think that actually is a correct statement of law. I cited a case, and I'm going to probably say the name wrong, but it's Stace versus Cao, C-A-O. It is a Minnesota Supreme Court case, and it's this set of facts. And essentially what the Supreme Court said, not plain error, particularly if the prosecutor is using that statement as a launching pad or springboard to argue why you should believe the victim in the particular case. That's exactly what happened here. If you look at the first time, the prosecutor actually said the comment about Emma alone being sufficient twice. And it was really a bookend to 7 pages in the transcript about why the jury should believe M.O. because of the corroboration of his trial testimony. So that is, I think, very clearly not plain error. With regard to the untimely judgment of acquittal motion, you're right. We did concede that that was plain error. It was plain error.
And what happened then? Remind me, what happened after the motion was asserted, taken under advisement or not ruled on, what evidence came in before the court actually did deny those motions?
Okay, and again, Slaughter, that is what the court is supposed to consider when you're looking at prejudice, which is, was the defense put in jeopardy of somehow putting in evidence that would have filled gaps in the prosecution's case? That didn't happen here. The witnesses that were testified were, one, the defense expert was called, and my read of the transcript, I looked back this morning, it looked like his testimony was broken up. So part of his testimony came in before the judgment of acquittal motion was ruled upon. There was a gym teacher from Emma's school, and Emma's therapist testified. None of those witnesses provided testimony that would have filled any kind of an alleged gap. All of them, well, I'm going to set the expert aside for a moment, but the gym teacher and the therapist were both called to say that M.O. hadn't reported to them and that they hadn't observed anything, any indicia of starvation or physical abuse. So that's the purpose. I think it's obvious from the record, and if you look at both opening statements of both defense counsel, that these were witnesses that were going to be called regardless of the ruling on the motion for judgment of acquittal. The claim I just heard was that the medical expert testimony would have changed had the motion of for a judgment of acquittal been granted. I actually don't think the record supports that argument either. The difference between, I mean, the claims, the or the, sorry, the charges were great bodily harm and substantial bodily harm. The testimony of that expert was there was no evidence of abuse.
So no harm at all.
No harm at all. That this was a perfectly, all the information provided by the state's expert about the growth and the malnourishment and the physical abuse, all of that was wrong, and that they're just, this was a child who had a normal physical trajectory. That's what the expert testified to. I find it difficult to believe that that would have materially changed. I also don't think that the district court erred when it ultimately did rule on the motion for a judgment of acquittal. The court focused solely on the state's evidence, acknowledged that it was a close question, but felt that the law commanded the district court to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution and, as a consequence, denied the motion for a judgment of acquittal. I think the lack of prejudice is also demonstrated by the fact ultimately the jury did acquit on the highest count. So for me, that is a strong point in favor of a finding of no prejudice in this particular case. Appellant did not receive a perfect trial, and the prosecution isn't saying that, but nobody receives a perfect trial. It's a human effort and a human endeavor. I myself have handled the appeals in my own cases, riddled with error. And error does not warrant reversal unless it's prejudicial. None of the claims that appellant has made in this particular case show prejudice or substantial prejudice, and the state would ask that this court affirm Ms. Yonas's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Perlmutter, you have the last word.
Thank you. Briefly, there was a statement that defense counsel specifically rejected a mistrial. That's not correct. Trial counsel wavered about whether or not to specifically ask for a mistrial. When they were discussing it on the record, the judge specifically said that's not going to happen. This was around the 1276 to 1343 page range, and this was when defense counsel was just alerted to the fact that these recordings existed and was talking about how she was inclined to ask for a mistrial and was considering it. And the trial judge did say this is not going to happen. This did affect the defendant's rights. It's apparent that trial counsel made the decision not to ask for a mistrial on the fly, and it was prejudicial to the defendant. One last clarifying point, the state argued that the theory remained the same, or the strategy rather remained the same. The theory was that the complaining witness was not credible, that he was making up these allegations, and that the client was innocent. The strategy would have changed based on these issues that we brought up.
In what way?
Well, it's possible that they would have cross-examined witnesses differently. It's possible that they wouldn't have had...
If what? Now, what are we talking about in terms of... Are you focusing on the discovery violation
now? First, we can focus on the discovery violations. If they had this information that they could have gotten through cross-examination of witnesses or direct examination of their own witnesses, it's possible that they would not have put the client on the stand. They would have cross-examined differently. They would have put forth their theory in a more effective way throughout their directs and crosses in this case. So that is not a theory. That's a strategy of the case and the strategy of presenting the theory of narrative of innocence to the jury. And that could have been done more effectively if they had this information. And that is really all that I have today. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.